resistance training, strength training. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think we're going to have a lot of agreements today in terms of frequency, habits, and trying to work towards bettering ourselves.
I mean, we can try to find something to disagree on.
We don't.
That'd be more interesting.
We don't need to disagree.
Yeah, but arguing is fun.
I'm not a very argumentative person.
I disagree.
I'm not one person to sit there and argue with a person.
You are.
I'm more of a person that's going to vote with my feet.
Or are you lying to the listeners?
By just leaving the situation, if I can. Today we're going to be talking about Atomic Habits by James Clear. It was published when? I think I wrote it down, but 2018, I think. Doesn't matter. We'll put that in. This will be our third episode, our second book for the podcast. And if you haven't listened to the last two episodes, I'm Joel. And we have Leo here. Oh, sorry. You can introduce yourself.
I'm Leo. That's Joel.
And this is going to be the Deep Dive Book Club podcast. Thanks for joining. Maybe you read Atomic Habits. Maybe you haven't. But today we're going to be
having... did come out in 2018.
Thank you. But today we're going to be having a open and candid conversation about what we read, our interactions and discussions with our in-person book club, and go through what I hope to point out is good aspects that we can take away and use in our daily life. And I have found that it has helped me reframe my thinking about my habits. And so outside of like the other quote-unquote self-help book genre, the thing I liked about this is it had a good reframing mentality. And I want to point those things out and not only give myself, but the listeners, more things to think about to improve their lives. And I think the lasting sentence that I'll say at the end of the episode as well is, reduce your ambition will help increase your ambition and success later. And by that, and we'll get into it, I mean reducing the things that you think about you have to get done. Don't think you have to go work out for 2 hours every day. Think, I just need to go to the gym. And that gets you on the track to success. That'll lead to bigger monuments being achieved.
Okay, so you don't want to talk about that now? You want to talk about that later?
I was just giving a little teaser to say this is what I fully got out of it. If I were to give the TLDR summary, and I'll give it at the end, what I would like to do, unless you have anything to add.
I mean, at a top level, my biggest takeaway is the quote from the book. Every action you take is a vote for the person you're going to become or the person you want to become. I actually encountered that quote, you know, forever ago before actually reading the book. I think it was an interview of James Clear on some podcast I was listening to. And that sentence, for whatever reason, really just stuck with me. And I've used it in my personal life and business life ever since. And so I don't know when I heard that, but it was several years ago, and it's stood the test of time. And for book club, this book came up, we read it, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is where that quote comes from. And so before even reading the book, my takeaway was that sentence. And after reading the book, same thing. That's my biggest takeaway.
And I think that is exactly how I felt about the book, is not necessarily that it gave me new tools to use, but rather it had some good reframings that helped me think better about my small actions and how they can compound. And it's funny because I had that quote written down here. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become. No single instance will transform your beliefs, but as the votes build up, so does the evidence of your new identity. And I really like that quote, and I'm glad you brought it up. So that is another one of the biggest takeaways I had.
Yeah, that's easily the biggest takeaway. Yeah, I agree that there's some good reframing that's available, you know, in the book. There's definitely probably the one I like the most, and we can talk about it, is the identity side of it. I think that's very helpful and can really help a lot of people. But in general, the tools and the framework that he lays out for habits is, I think, really helpful for someone who's wanting to think consciously about their habits or really work on a habit that's kind of given them some trouble. So I think it's a worthwhile book just for that.
Oh, absolutely. I was even telling Ava that even if she doesn't read the book, let me read the chapter summaries to you and talk about how you can use them, because most people in my life and by proxy your life as well have at least one habit that they're trying to improve on or a bad habit they're trying to get rid of, right? Anyone that's trying to be critical of their life and improve their life has at least one thing that they want to improve.
Right. And you mentioned the chapter summaries. Those are definitely some of the best chapter summaries that I've seen in a book. Okay. So where do you want to start?
So I was hoping that I could start by laying out the main portion of the book almost in the chapter summaries itself and talk about that with you a little bit so that we don't lose any of the small pieces. And then hopefully you can bring in the discussions and highlight the bigger portions or the more impactful portions.
Sure, yeah.
Great. So starting with the top of it, we're going to break this down, as James Clear does, into four different parts. And I'm going to focus on the positive for making habits. And that's only because that's the biggest part that stuck with me to take away. Because in my mind, which could be wrong, if you focus on having good positive habits, you can worry less about the negative small habits or perhaps the neutral habits, because those will fall away as you keep inputting good stuff. Granted, there are things such as like smoking or bad eating that you could focus on removing, but I have a bigger focus on inputting.
And that reminds me of something that has also stuck with me for several years and that lines up very nicely with what James Clear is talking about in this book. I had a coach one time who, you know, we were talking about, he had just got done giving someone some advice on something, and we were kind of talking about the philosophy behind what he recommends, when he recommends it, why he recommends it. And this person in particular, you know, really needed to lose some extra weight. And he told me his strategy for coaching this person was that, hey, you know, making a bunch of changes, you know, really quickly, especially if it's the kind of the making yourself a no list, like don't drink soda, don't drink this, don't do that, don't eat this, makes it much harder. What he said instead was he tries to, as much as possible, add stuff in. So instead of telling that person, don't drink a soda, tell them they got to eat an avocado a day. Tell them they got to eat, you know, 3 cups of greens a day. Whatever it is, add stuff in. And kind of like what you said, focusing on that, the positive side of it, in multiple senses of the word, helps edge the other stuff out. And that kind of lines up with one of the things that James Clear talks about, is that give yourself little wins, give yourself evidence of the type of person you want to be, of the habit you have. If you give yourself evidence and proof that, oh, I can do this, I am doing this, it reinforces the identity of someone who is just successfully having that as a positive habit. It makes it easier, and you're helping convince yourself, really. So if it's eating healthy, just slowly add in. Like if you're eating 3 cups of greens a day and your diet doesn't change whatsoever beyond that, but you're able to do that for 2 weeks straight, you have 2 weeks worth of evidence that shows like you're a person that can eat healthier. And it just slowly makes it go from there, add some more stuff in. And that's one of the things he talks about, you know, make incremental changes. He's very big, especially in the beginning of the book, about making incremental changes and giving yourself evidence for the type of person that you want to become. So yeah, absolutely. I understand why you want to focus on the positive aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. That's my focus. And you saying incrementalism, we'll start with kind of his opening introduction of the 1%, you know, improvement and how that can compound over time. Same thing with saving money. 1% over time compounds to be great monumental things. So anytime you're going to climb the mountain or do anything big, it's going to start small. And so by focusing on that, we'll get into the first section, what she calls make it obvious. And I do like that. And the three subcategories that he has inside of that is he starts with the scorecard and the current state, or basically make a spreadsheet or list of what your current habits are. Wake up, make a cup of coffee, check Instagram, so on and so forth. And that is a nice thing that I looked at once and I was like, oh, okay, most of my things are neutral, but I could add more positives. And that's kind of overviewing where are you now? And even if you don't write it down, I found it helpful to just sit there and pontificate on the things that I do focus on, because you, even if you have a trouble identifying who you are, if you sit back and think about how you spend your treasures, and our treasures being time and money, you'll know intrinsically the things that are important to you. So what do you spend your time and money on?
Health and fitness and books.
So clearly these are some of the most intricate portions for you. And when I thought about, well, what do I spend my time and money on? What are my current time consumers? That happened to be spending time with loved ones and sometimes playing games or music or other things. And I went through and thought about the positive, neutral, and negatives. And it was a good reminder to myself of what am I actually doing and what am I willing to give up and what am I wanting to focus on further. So that's the thing people could do. I don't know how useful it'll be. The second one is the implementation intention, or basically writing down, I will do A at B time and C place. And the example he gave was people working out, and very shortly, there are different groups of people working out, and the people that were the most consistent with working out was the control group, where they had them write down, I will work out every Tuesday for 30 minutes doing jumping jacks, or whatever it was that they wrote down. But the fact of writing it down made it more likely to occur.
Yeah, if I make myself a to-do list and I actually write down everything I need to get done, there's something magical about just having that orients the rest of the day for me to actually get everything done. Same thing with habits. This is just playing on a larger scale. If you make a very specific plan for what you want to do and when you want to do it, adding in the time and the place being a very important part of the equation that he recommends is essential. So yeah, if you are like, I'm going to start eating healthy, well, that doesn't capture the when, and it doesn't capture the where. You know, I'm going to eat every Monday and Tuesday. I'm going to eat at home, and I'm going to go to the grocery store on Sunday so I have something healthy I can make for the next couple days. Very, very simple plan, but it covers the when and where. Yeah.
Yeah. I see it being very useful. And I find that when I focus on the exact when and where, I'm more likely to follow through with my plans. I guess one thing he doesn't talk about necessarily, which maybe doesn't even need to be talked about, is whatever your goals are, they should be positive goals. But what even counts as a positive goal? I think all of the goals that I set for myself are positive.
Well, if someone's got the goal of stop smoking, that's a thing you're removing. There's lots of mental things you can do to reframe that, and there's lots of stuff you can do. And he has some great tools and examples in the book. Everyone who's interested in habits, again, should read the book. This is just us talking about it. But there's stuff where it's just like, stop drinking, stop smoking, stop going to McDonald's. There's, you know, if you achieve that, it's positive, but you're not adding something in, you're removing something. So
right.
You can do kind of mental gymnastics to get yourself to the point where you're like, I'm adding something in by passing McDonald's and not going in. I'm adding years to my life. I'm adding, you know, more quality years towards the end of my life to spend with my loved ones rather than, you know, unhealthy dying.
Right. Yeah. Or in my case, it's I eat healthy, One, because I love eating healthy, but two, because it supports the things I want to do. I just returned from a rock climbing trip up to Virginia, where I was physically fit and was able to climb more climbs and do more things and have the energy to do that. And part of me wanting to do these things is backtracking to having positive habits towards food and exercise even before I go do that.
To kind of tie it back to what he was saying with making sure you tie a habit to both a time and place and make it very specific, that implementation intention that he talks about, I think a reason that we sometimes don't do that is because if we define exactly what success looks like, we are at the exact same time also defining failure. So if you make it a goal to eat healthy and you feel good about making that intention, I'm going to eat healthy. That kind of makes you feel better, but it doesn't really lead to any action. However, if you say that I am going to go shopping on Sunday, get a bunch of Whole Foods, get enough to make meals made out of Whole Foods to eat Monday and Tuesday, and that's that, and I'm going to stay at home and cook that Monday and Tuesday. That makes it a lot more clear. And when Monday comes, if you have failed to do that, then you will have very clear evidence of you failing to meet a goal, you failing to meet a pattern that you're trying to establish for yourself. And failure hurts. Failure doesn't feel good. Failure is evidence for more bad things to come to our human psychology. A sense of failure hits us hard because it, going back to the fear of death, it's a pattern that could ultimately to our animal brains lead to our ultimate failure, death. And so failure hurts. Even if it's on a small scale that doesn't matter that much, it hurts us psychologically. We don't like it. Doesn't feel good. So being very specific about what we want to do can very much cause a little bit of anxiety. And I think sometimes we're afraid to do that, but we have to get outside of our comfort zone to really make progress and move where we want to move.
I absolutely agree with you. I think we're going to have a hard time arguing today, but if we'll
see about that.
All right. But if we recall, kind of tying that back into a fictional book that we've already read in Crime and Punishment, Marmeladov, if I'm saying that character's name right, he was the drunken character in the tavern where he said, "Look at how bad I am. I got drunk. I stole the money that my wife went and got and got drunk on it. I'm a terrible person." And to kind of truncate his story is, I really think Dostoevsky did a great job of capturing human nature. And in that character, kind of relates to, well, I already did these bad things in the past, or I already squandered all this money. These are the evidence for me to identify as a not bad villainous character, but a character that will choose a bad answer again in a situation. In his case, Marmeladov's is squandering money or getting drunk.
Yeah, Dostoevsky perfectly captures, you know, the psychology of someone who's a late stage alcoholic in the character Marmeladov from Crime and Punishment. So you're saying tie that into failure and being specific about goals?
Absolutely. What you were saying in the contra of the evidence to be a good person, we also create the evidence to be a bad person. Right. And I've seen that in people where if they set up these failures and they feel failure again and again, then they further progress their idea that, oh, actually, I can't do this difficult thing or I can't change because here's the evidence of me being a bad person. And a fictional representation of that.
Yeah. OK, so you're saying someone gets stuck in an identity and they just feel captured by that identity. Yes. And can't get over it. If, you know, someone is overweight and is feeling down about that and feeling down about their weight and feels stuck, then very much so they could feel like, oh, I have all this evidence of failing to be healthy. Therefore, I'm never going to be able to get out of it.
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't James Clear at some point talk about, you know, you have to feel like you can change. You have to believe that you can change. Or is that something that really kind of emerged from our discussions in our in-person book club?
I don't remember him saying that specifically in the book, but we did talk about it in the in-person book club, where you need to believe that you can change, or you have to have the intrinsic desire to change before you can even change the systems or habits.
Well, you can want all you want. If someone's overweight and doesn't want to be overweight and feels captured by it, you know, they could really want to not be overweight. But I think what's missing in the example that you're giving is they don't believe that they can change.
Yes, I think that's part of it.
And that's a little bit oversimplistic, but yes, I think that's an essential thing that's missing in that example, is that person doesn't believe they can change.
And I can think of, and I'm sure our listeners can think of, people in their life that they've seen get stuck on an identity and say, well, this is who I am. And the unspoken part is, well, I can't change because this is who I am. Well, I have OCD, so I can't do anything about it. I have whatever, or I am whatever, therefore I can't change this. And I chose Mara Milladov just because he's a beautiful fictional representation of that.
Yeah, good memory of Mara Milladov there. Definitely enjoyed reading about that character.
We'll get to Crime and Punishment.
I definitely want to read Dostoevsky, for sure. I think I've only read a book or two by his, and I definitely want to read more. I've never seen a better, I know this is a bit of digression, but I've never seen a better representation in literature of human psychology from Dostoevsky, from other people besides Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky does a masterful job.
I do think he's a master in capturing true human psychology in his books. But we'll get to his book. The last thing...
Back to habits.
The last thing in his Make It Obvious section is habit stacking. And the easiest thing for him, or one of the examples that stuck with me, was you come home and you put your work bag down, you immediately put on your shoes. And then after you put on your shoes, that's the initiation of you going for a run. So the putting the work bag down, the next thing you do is grab the shoes. So that small action, such as putting on the shoes, will then lead to a better action. And this is all interconnected in his book, but that leads to you doing positive choices. Or you get up and you do a stretch, and then immediately followed by your stretch, you start your coffee. Immediately as soon as you have your coffee, you journal. And you create your brain to have a automatic pathway of, I have done X, now I will do Y. And you stack those habits, or in my head, it's more of like chaining the habits together.
Yeah, you're creating a sequence, a pattern that you're used to.
And the best I see that is creating morning routines. So as soon as you get up and you have, for me, it's coffee. As soon as I have coffee, that smell or that taste then leads me to start whatever positive action I want to do, which is typically journaling for me.
I heard someone once give the example of something very similar, where they wanted to make flossing a habit. Therefore, they kept a bag of those floss picks in their car, and they just made it a habit. Every time I get in the car, I grab a flosser, I floss, you know, while I'm driving. But that, and this is tying in a few of the tools that James Clear brings up in his book, but that's, you know, a version of habit stacking. Well, I have to get in the car, so might as well add on to that chain, like you were saying, of let me go ahead and grab a flosser.
Yeah. So I think the Make It Obvious was a good chapter or a good section. Not my favorite. I do really like the next two. So do you have anything else to add?
Well, I know you've got some some more general opinions about the idea of habit stacking to begin with. We can zoom out a little bit and just sure. talk about the philosophical implications of even beginning to think about habit stacking. So I think one thing that we discussed, and again, I don't remember if this is you and me off air or if this was in our in-person book club, but I think habit stacking is a very powerful tool that can be brought to bear. However, I also think it's one of those things that you need to be careful about the, for me at least, the philosophy underlying that mental tool. And for me, you run into an issue similar to what Byung-Chul Han calls the achievement society and the achievement subject. You turn yourself into an endless project, self as project, and you can lose meaning and get hyper focused on progress and productivity to the detriment of other things in your life.
I absolutely agree with you.
I thought we were going to argue.
Bringing back, there's no argument today. Bringing back the burnout society, I really think habit stacking can be overused to put yourself in a achievement subjugation society. Probably not using the words correctly.
Right. But and it's not necessarily like using habit stacking, but the tool implies an underlying philosophy. Yeah. But right. Go ahead.
And so I will say sometimes we need to zoom out and think, well, it's okay to just be human. It's okay that you weren't the most productive or the most successful today. Like on the holidays, so I don't like drinking. I also get drunk if I have half a beer and I don't enjoy drinking. But if I go to a wedding or when I travel to other countries, I don't keep that rigid non-drinking mentality at all times because I want to still feel human, and it's okay to not be the most productive or the most successful every single day, because that's not what being human is to me and my personal philosophy.
Right. And if you're hyper-focused on productivity or making progress or seeing yourself as a self-improvement project, then you could have some emotional baggage and hang-ups when it comes to trying to unwind and relax a little bit at a wedding or on the holidays. Right. Absolutely. And to what you said earlier, you know, I think habit stacking is a useful tool. I think it's something that most people can easily use to make things more streamlined in our life and make things a little bit more orderly. I just know that we had some good conversations about, okay, what are the assumptions underlying talking about this? And for me, what are the potential unintended mental or psychological side effects of that? And I think using that tool could increase the chances of leaning too hard into self as project. But I don't want to take away from the tool itself nor the book. The book is good, and that's a good tool to use. I've heard of it, you know, from other places besides this book, but he does, like everything he lays out in here, even if I've already heard of it, he does a really good job of talking about it and discussing it. So yeah, don't want to take anything away from there, but I do want to, as we go through this, kind of point out some of the underlying assumptions and philosophies that are sitting underneath the text itself, because this is Deep Dive Book Club.
Oh, absolutely. Not to take away from anything James Clear has done, and this is an excellent book, but his book is absolutely seeped deep into the sea of Western post-industrial ideology of progression, of being an achievement society subject, of flagellating yourself so that you can go forward and continue to progress in your achievements and gather more money and all these things, right? I don't think you can take away this book outside of that post-industrialized Western ideology, which in the Burnout Society very accurately describes the burnout from being an achievement subject.
Have we mentioned Burnout Society in the last two episodes at all?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure we have made that reference clear to people. Okay, so that is the Make It Obvious section. Next up is Make It Attractive. You want to take a quick break and we can jump into the next section?
Sure, yeah, we can take a break.
Anything else you want to talk about on this one?
No, I'm much more excited to get into section 2 and 3.
Make it attractive, make it easy. Okay, those are coming up next. Quick break.
So what do you want to tell me about?
Sardine fasting.
All right, tell me about the sardine
fasting. I heard it on a
fasting.
Podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts. So sardine fasting is what this one guy does who eats keto, who, you know, sometimes he wants to do a longer period of fasting, whether it's for a few days, a week, or whatever. And he will eat a single can of sardines each day for the fast. Why are you confused?
Why does he eat a single can of sardines? Why sardines?
That's the sardine fast. You eat nothing else but a single can of sardines per day.
I can think of a lot of things you could eat as your only item. I just don't understand the sardines.
High in the right kinds of fat and a good variety of micronutrients. Yeah, if I had a steady source of guaranteed mercury-free fish, sure, I'd eat more fish.
You know, we could move to Japan. They have a lot of fish over in Japan.
It's probably cleaner.
They have insanely clean food. The quality of life is really good. Now, the quality of their work life, pretty bad. But when I was over there, some of the Japanese people I was talking to were saying that there is a change in the culture to hopefully move more towards a relaxed society in the workplace.
That'd be interesting to see how that develops and what are the unintended consequences of that.
Yeah, it would.
All right, you ready to talk about atomic habits?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm waiting on you. Okay, so when we last left off, we had just finished his first section, which is Make It Obvious, and now we're going to be talking about Make It Attractive. And he opens up this section with a really good story of some engineering student that needed to work out. And he basically puts out that he wanted to tie in working out with what he wanted to do, which was watching Netflix. So he hooked up his Netflix computer, TV, whatever, to a stationary bike, and he had to pedal at a certain rotation in order to power the TV to be on so that he can watch Netflix. And so you can immediately see that is a really easy and good example of what he calls temptation bundling, or basically pairing something you don't like with something you do like.
How do you feel about temptation bundling? Well, I guess let's back up and talk about temptation in general. Another thing he claims in the section where he's talking about temptation is that we face a lot more temptation in the modern world than our ancestors had to face in hunter-gatherer settings.
Yeah.
He gives the examples of like hard liquor, video games, junk food. What do you agree with his assessment there?
Well, I think it's pretty easy. I mean, for me, I can resist everything except for temptation.
Ha.
Ha. I think we do have easy access to a lot more dopamine or feel-good activities or foods that we didn't have, right? So you just didn't have the choice. 1,000 years ago, you had no choice to be on Instagram or TikTok and scroll. You had no choice to have unlimited all-you-can-eat buffets.
I think one argument that came up as a counterpoint to that in the in-person book club is that a lot of times, you know, humans are so adaptable, they just get used to the environment they're in. So one possible counter-argument, I don't know that I agree with it, is that while yes, there may be more temptations now, we're used to it. We're desensitized to the sheer amount of temptation that we experience on a day-to-day basis in our modern society and civilization. And if you were to extract, take a time machine, extract a hunter-gatherer from 10,000 years ago and drop him or her off here, that they just couldn't handle it because they don't have a lifetime of being used to it.
I think the transporting a hunter-gatherer to our time, it does make sense. They don't have the built-in self-resistance for these things. But I still think that we have a education level enough and a mentality level enough to understand that these things are bad, but it's still hard to overcome those temptations when it's so easy. The friction in order to get them, or the barriers in order to enjoy quote-unquote bad things for us, is lowered. And so when you do give in to temptation, it's right there.
I don't know that the average level of education or access to information has much influence whatsoever on the lure and attractiveness of modern temptations like junk food, video games, and hard liquor. You know, you can be educated all you want, but if you really want to drink, you know, there's no logical explanation. You can't sit there and tell the part of your brain that wants the liquor that, well, you know, it's going to inflame your liver. It causes all kinds of metabolic problems, killing some gut microbiome civilians that, you know, don't want you to have that alcohol, and inflames the brain. Like, you can explain logically all this stuff, and that, you know, even that you're just not going to feel that great the next day. And the part of your brain that wants the booze is like, it's not listening. It's like Bender from Futurama, not listening to you, going straight for the booze.
I understand on the individual level. I agree with you. Like I said at the beginning of this podcast, I think there'll be a lot of agreeing. But I do think education is the first stepping stone in order to forego that. The easiest example I can think of is the tobacco industry. Back in the early 1900s, we didn't necessarily know how bad tobacco was for you. And so people would give into their temptation easier, right, to smoke. And that's with the modern day idea that smoking is bad for you. And then we finally have all of this research and data coming out in the mid-1950s and 60s where, oh, actually all this lung cancer is showing up. All of this is really bad, so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean that the individuals changed. But then we see that our generation and the previous generation were the first two generations that we have recorded that have less smokers than the prior generation.
See, I think with the trend away from smoking cigarettes, the education and availability of information may have helped a little bit, but I don't think that's what changed anyone's mind. I think what changed people's mind is the social pressure. So there was a push to, you know, ban smoking in restaurants and ban smoking in certain public areas. And there was just a gradual push from there. And I think it turned into social pressure. This would be a great subject to read about or do some research on. But, you know, from my recollection, that's what I think was the main impetus, was just the sheer social pressure of, well, no one else is smoking and that, and people don't like it nowadays. So, you know, it just kind of that, the social pressure of wanting to fit in, I think outweighed people's desire to keep smoking.
And my only argument is that the social pressure was preceded by all the research saying that this is bad and we should try to force it out of children's hands or out of the social arena.
Yeah, maybe. I'd be really interested to know, you know, the composition of what caused the changes there.
That'd be cool. We'll look into it more. But back to temptation bundling. For me, I think one of the ways that I use temptation bundling, I didn't think about this at all. And in fact, when we talked about it for the first time, I was like, nope, I don't do temptation bundling. But then someone brought up podcasts. And I was like, oh, actually, when I do chores or wash dishes or mow the lawn, I do listen to podcasts. And I enjoy those tasks because I'm listening to a podcast.
Well, how come you don't listen to the podcast I send you?
I listen to the podcasts you send me. I love podcasts.
Just not the ones I send you.
I listen to... I forget
exactly.
I forget the guy's name, but his podcasts are really long. The Martyr Made podcast, that's a very good podcast. You sent that to me.
Really good podcast.
I listened to it. The social pressure being the reason why people avoided smoking cigarettes or pushed towards being like, well, my friends aren't doing it anymore, or I can't do it in public places. And I do agree that that was a strong push to getting rid of smoking, or why some people chose not to do it anymore. In the same way, drinking. If none of your friends drink, you're probably less likely to drink. If none of your friends do drugs, you're less likely to do drugs. And that's actually bundles into the second portion of his Make It Attractive, which is to join a culture or a group. And I think we've all heard similar sagely sayings about this kind of, if you show me your friends, I'll show you your future, or so forth. And I don't think we can overstate how powerful our friends, our families, and the groups that we're a part of influence us. We are inherently social creatures. And just by changing who you're around will absolutely change your trajectory and future, no matter how stalwart of a person you are.
He did talk about that. And I thought he would go more into that aspect of it. But yeah, that I think that's a major key. Your rehab only works if you don't go back into the context you came out of when you went into rehab.
Yeah, I think a lot of rehab situations, they remove you from your place. And then when they try to put you back into society, it's in a new context. And there's been lots of research about if you go back to the same old context or hang out with the same old friends, a lot of people relapse into that problem that they have, be it drugs or alcohol.
Okay, so still in the same section of Making It Attractive, in chapter 10, one thing he writes that I wanted to talk about is, quote, every behavior has a surface level craving and a deeper underlying motive. An example would be, you know, smoking a cigarette addresses your desire to exert control and have calmness, calm down, you know. How true do you think that is? This is something that we talked about in the in-person book club, and we had some good conversations around this.
Sure. I think there is a lot of underlying cravings that we have, and they bubble up to the surface and they manifest in various ways. Sometimes it's the fear of death, like we talked about with Ernest Becker. Sometimes it's various other things for survival or wanting to eat or feel love and self-actualization. Every once in a while, I do think there's just a misfiring of neurons. And as Sigmund Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yeah, but it is very tempting to think about there being an underlying motivation behind, you know, pretty much any little arbitrary behavior. Some of them, you know, it might be a little bit harder to pin down the underlying motive, but I don't know. There's something to that. There's something to that. And maybe it's not a straight line, but maybe it's more like a pressure, you know, like, oh, well, you're smoking a cigarette because you want to be calm, but maybe there's other pressures that are exerting themselves on you. Maybe you're used to having a specific relationship with the act of consumption. That's something I've thought about before. It's like the act of consuming is something that, unfortunately, I think happens too much as a mental habit in American society. So, you know, you could have a kind of dysfunctional relationship with that. Does that make sense? And therefore, that can be like what you fall back to, like, oh, I want to feel calmer, or I want to feel better, or whatever. You're trying to relieve yourself somehow. And the method that you're used to, you know, getting from point A to point B or accomplishing anything is the act of consumption itself.
Yeah, I agree with you. Especially in America, we have this consumeristic ideology. And one thing James Clear talks about, and many people have talked about, is that our brains are really just prediction machines. So they're predicting the outcome of a situation, or they're recalling the last time they were in a similar situation in order to solve the current events. And in this case, if you are stressed out, your brain is recalling the last time it was able to calm itself down. Or if you're hungry, it's recalling the last time it was able to find food. And in the response of lighting up a cigarette, your brain's like, well, last time I felt stressed, I lit up a cigarette and I felt calm. And so your brain inserts that cue, the craving, and then the response is to light up a cigarette, and then you get the result, which would be a calming effect.
I think another thing we talked about in regards to this is, you know, have you ever successfully redirected yourself when you thought about, okay, what's my real intention here? What's my deeper motivation here? Have you ever gone through that mental exercise and like, man, I really want, you know, whatever it is, and then tried to dig a little bit deeper, find out the true motive, and then redirected based off of that?
I've used that system for food consumption, where I have a craving for a food and I attempt to backtrack, why is my brain inserting this craving for this particular food, and then try to address that in a healthy manner. For example, sometimes I'm like, I really am craving ice cream or a smoothie, and I backtrack. It's like, oh, actually, I think I'm just dehydrated, so let me give my body water instead and quench the craving that way, rather than getting the high sugary result of ice cream.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. You know, man, I really want popcorn, but maybe it's just the salt I want. And if it's the salt, maybe I just need some, you know, go get some electrolytes. Okay, so back to the question at hand. You know, we have the food example, but beyond that, I can't really think of an example of changing, like redirecting a craving. You know, part of that, I think, maybe related to that is maybe, you know, I'm feeling some anger or frustration, and like stopping to question that and think about it and kind of try to find the underlying motives and intentions behind that. That usually helps me course correct and resolve something, or sometimes it'll even diffuse it right there. Like, oh, I'm feeling frustrated because, you know, I was in the car for 10 hours yesterday, or whatever it happens to be. And that just being able to name and address it sometimes just diffuses it. But as far as redirecting a habit or action by finding the deeper underlying motive, and nothing's really jumping out at me.
I do find the redirecting to be a useful tool for me, but oftentimes that takes the form of something I think I've already developed as a habit, which is I feel stressed, and my stress response is often to go work out or go for a run or do these activities if they're available to me. But finding the underlying motive outside of the food realm and then redirecting it, I don't know that I've done that much in my life. But it is a tool that perhaps resonates with other people and could be useful in different situations. The next one that he talks about is the motivational ritual, which is doing a small thing right before you have a hard task. The example of some athletes having a specific stretching ritual or warm-up ritual before they do something. And actually, for us recording the podcast, for me, it's making a cup of coffee. And I know that when I have this cup of coffee at your house and I'm drinking it, I'm setting up the stuff, I'm gearing my brain up to do this task. Even though I enjoy doing it, we all still have rituals that kind of prep our brain to get into a mode to do something.
Yeah, he gives the example of athletes, like you said, doing particular stretching routine, but like doing exactly the same thing in the same sequence as they're getting ready for a game or getting ready for a performance or whatever it is. So there's definitely something to that, you know, step by step, whether it's, you know, okay, first I put in my left headphone, then my right headphone, and then I put on both socks, and then I put on both shoes, and then I go grab this thing off the shelf. whatever it happens to be, you know, there's definitely something to that, and your brain starts to get entrained towards what it knows is coming next, and you kind of get pulled along with that pressure you build up for whatever the activity is. So if it's a workout and you're kind of tired, you're not feeling very motivated, if you just go put on your shoes, I think James Clear even gives that example, just go put on your shoes and then, you know, try to let the pressure build from there. All right, go get in the car. You don't have to go anywhere. Just go get in the car. All right. You know, and it just kind of inevitably pulls you along, and that helps you get stuff in motion.
Yeah, I think that works great. And especially with reducing the friction for people to do things, I think it's a lot easier for you to tell your brain, hey, instead of I'm going to go to the gym and work out for an hour, you just say to your brain, hey, I'm going to drive to the gym. I'm just going to drive to the gym. And you're making a smaller task that can then lead to a much bigger event that will, over the long term, allow for you to have a better life. So instead of saying, I'm going to go on a run, say, I'm going to put my running shoes on.
I think we talked about this last time, but that also touches on the aspect of aiming for perfection. A lot of times gets in the way of just consistency and getting stuff done. So in the example of where you feel like crap and you don't feel like working out, but you work out for an hour every time, you know, maybe it's okay to have a crappier or shorter workout. At least you get in the gym and you get it done. You know, depends on what you're doing and what your goals are, but, you know, at least showing up and doing something is better than doing nothing. A lot of times, and I know my brain works this way, if I don't feel like I can, you know, do 100% exactly what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, then like I start getting frustrated, like, ah, man, I'm falling off the wagon. I'm not meeting my goals. I'm not going to make the progress I want to make. When the reality is, if I'm having a crappy day, just get in the gym and just do a little bit of something, do something nominal, go through the motions and, you know, work on recovery. And that helps because I very much get frustrated with it, feeling like I'm falling off the wagon. And that, I know that happens with a lot of people. This is definitely something that came up in book club where, you know, that multiple people have experienced that. Do you experience that?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely experienced that. For me, when I'm getting into the gym, I'm much more extroverted and a social creature. So oftentimes when I am going to work out, the thing that is helping lift me up is the idea that, oh, I need to work out and be healthy and fit to be a good brother, to be a good husband, to be a good uncle, to fulfill all of these social roles and better myself so that I can better others around me. And if I feel bad or if I'm ill, especially if I'm not super sick, like if I'm bedridden sick, I typically don't have guilt. But if I'm like coughing, sneezing, and feeling crappy where I'm going to have a bad workout, or maybe it's probably best I don't work out, man, that guilt like builds up like a kinked garden hose.
Oh, it doesn't matter what level of debilitatingly sick I am. I'm still feeling guilty. It's just like general puritanical guilt just builds up. Oh, you're sick, huh? It must have been because you're bad.
Yeah, should feel bad.
Yep. Yeah, I do feel when I'm sick. It's like the overall systemic inflammation just takes over and I just feel just like a sorry piece of shit.
So I think of all the things he talks about in this book, this is one that I've taken away. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I knew these things in different words and in different ways of thinking, but I really enjoy James Clear's way of making it succinct and kind of obvious in a very approachable written rhetoric. And so making that motivational ritual is very useful, and it definitely helps. So if we're doing something like you want to journal every day in order to help yourself, or you want to meditate or anything like that, having like a small, very short, less than 2 minute activity chosen before your thing that you want to improve on or get better at or add to your life, then I feel like this absolutely gives you a pathway to build that preconceived cognitive motion, right? Stepping in the right direction takes you along the whole trek. And related to that is the last portion of the Make It Attractive section, which he talks about rewards. And obviously, we all know this Pavlovian method of rewarding, where you ring the bell and you give a dog a treat. And ultimately, you can ring the bell just to make the dog salivate because of the anticipation of that dopamine. So if you don't like working out and you work out, and then right after you give your brain a heavy dose of dopamine through whatever it is, social media scrolling, anything, then you're building your brain to say, hey, when I do this hard task, I get good reward. And he puts it in the realm of, and I'm kind of blending several different portions of the book here, but rewarding before, during, or after the tasks that you want to add to your life. We talked about the motivational ritual, or doing an enjoyable event, giving your brain the dopamine, and then doing that hard task. And then, of course, during, in this case, he would call it temptation bundling. And, of course, post, or most people, I think, probably already know this, understand this, or utilize it. What do you think?
About the motivational ritual? Yeah, it helps me a lot.
Yeah. So the motivational ritual, I would say, is a pre-activity reward for your brain.
Yeah, I like thinking about it more so what we just said about it gets, it just helps build up pressure, and it gets you, your brain, in train towards doing what you are wanting to do.
Do you utilize any post-activity rewards?
Not particularly. Nothing's really coming up there. Post-activity rewards, as far as like making something rewarding. Not really. I can't really think of an example. Let me think on that. I think I had the same, you know, thoughts when we were doing the in-person book club. That's not really something that really comes to mind.
Sure.
Like the smoothie after a workout is just part of the habit. You know, the smoothies I make don't taste very good. It's just got a bunch of the stuff that I need and none of the stuff I don't. So it's just like the last part of the workout is just drinking this smoothie.
Yeah, but your Spartanistic Stark approach towards this already gives your brain dopamine.
That's true.
Well, it tastes bad, so it must be bad for me. This displeasure is the joy that I bring to myself.
No, it tastes bad, therefore it must be good for me.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have anything you would like to add to the Make It Attractive section?
I do. I've got two more things that I would like to talk about.
Give it to me.
Okay, so let me grab my notes here. Okay, two more things I want to talk about. Do we want to take a quick break, or do we want to continue on?
Let us finish these two things to close out Make It Attractive. We'll take a break, and then we'll move on to Make It Easy.
All right. Then hang in there. The two things I want to talk about is preparation as a form of procrastination and the destination versus the journey. So preparation as a form of procrastination. There are efforts and endeavors that result in outcomes and those that don't really accomplish anything. The author calls this the difference between, quote, being in motion and taking action, end quote. You know the difference intuitively if you've ever walked out of a meeting and thought, that was a complete waste of time. Arguably, the worst version of this is using preparation as a form of procrastination because it gives a false sense of making progress. I've noticed this in people I've worked with before, where they spend a lot of time planning or filling out their calendar or building out a to-do list, and they lavish a lot of attention and detail on those things, and then I notice stuff is not really getting done. A lot of gum flapping and not a lot of action. Have you noticed this before?
Yes, and there is research articles relating to accomplishing tasks. And in the research, they find if you tell other people the accomplishment that you're attempting to do, your brain will release part of the dopamine from the visualization of achieving that success, reducing your craving to put forth the effort in order to achieve it.
Right.
So that's
why I always feel kind of weird knowing that. I always feel kind of weird when there's something I want to get done, like a big project or something, or something I'm working on. And then if I tell people about it, then I worry about, like, oh no, I'm cashing in the dopamine early. You know, I'm not going to feel motivated to keep going.
Yeah. I've taken the approach where people in our everyday life, I try to avoid telling them any project I'm working on or task I'm trying to accomplish so that I can let the slow build of dopamine come from actually doing it. The podcast, as an example, I try to minimize my talking about the podcast to in-person people.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about it that much in person. We're still baking in the kitchen, so to speak.
So I agree with you that planning can definitely be a form of procrastination. I'm guilty of that myself. I make a long, big to-do list. I make a weekly to-do list and a monthly to-do list. And all this time, I'm like, well, I'm planning to do this. I'm planning this. This is when I'll study for Italian and all of these things. And I'm like, ah, now I feel so good. I've planned for an hour. Well, time to take a break instead of doing anything I already planned.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. I'm pretty good at making very nicely detailed checklists that really kind of cover everything. Man, this is going to make the process so seamless and foolproof. And then that robs a lot of the dopamine right there. Or I just spend too much time and energy caught up in the dopamine of that task rather than the process that actually needs to be done.
I will say, at some point, though, you do need to get some planning done. But I think the more specific you can make your planning and objectives, the more likely you are to follow through with it. So, for example, I will work out every Tuesday and Thursday doing jumping jacks for 30 minutes at 5:30 when I get home from work. The more specific you can make something, the more likely you are to follow through with that task or activity.
And that helps you visualize what you're actually trying to get done. So if the goal is a little bit more complicated or the habit's a little bit more complicated than doing jumping jacks, writing stuff out and going through the details of planning it out. And this is related to a good discussion we had about habit contracts. You know, going through that motion really helps you kind of figure out what you're doing and really puts your mind in the visualization of what it's actually going to take to get the project or the task done. Or in the relation to habits, how you're going to actually practically get the habit done. So, yeah, I agree that a little bit of planning is necessary depending on the level of complexity and effort that's needed. But at the same time, don't let that planning rob you by cashing in dopamine early.
Absolutely. Or planning so much that you're trying to plan how to make it perfect when sometimes good is good enough.
Yeah. Another big problem that I've experienced, you know, where perfect's the enemy of good.
Sweet. And I think the next thing you're going to bring up is very important. Had I known, maybe we would have taken a break before, because I think it is a big topic.
Well, too bad. We're in it. Okay, so let's talk about destination versus journey. So one of the things James Clear talks about is the law of least effort. Like, the easier you make it, the more likely it is you're going to get it done. The more obstacles in the way of making it happen, the more effort it takes, the less likely it is to get done. Okay, so following the reasoning of the law of least effort, James Clear says we should make doing our habits as easy as possible. Remove as much friction as we can. And here's a quote. Quote, in a sense, every habit is just an obstacle to getting what you really want. Dieting is an obstacle to getting fit. Meditation is an obstacle to feeling calm. Later on, he says, you don't actually want the habit itself. What you really want is the outcome the habit delivers. And a little bit further on, the more difficult the habit, the more friction there is between you and your desired end state. So I'm of two minds about this, and this is a pretty good discussion point for us to talk about. I think there's two ways you can interpret this. You know, one is getting kind of caught up in the almost as self as project, you know, what some of the stuff we saw in Byung-Chul Han's Burnout Society. So here's the two versions that I can think of. So thinking like this can make you feel like you have to achieve or make progress to feel happy. You end up focusing only on the destination, which is so finite and insignificant when compared to the time spent on the journey itself and the potential pleasure and meaning you can get from it. And that's definitely something I've been guilty of. So overly focused on the goal and kind of not enjoying the journey because you're so hell-bent focused on the goal. Other version of this is keeping your desired end state in mind and staying focused on it will keep you on track and help minimize wasted effort. You can achieve and accomplish a lot by focusing on results and orienting yourself strongly around getting those results. And this is something that also has helped me, you know, keeping my eye on the target. And I really like the word orienting because that just clicks for me as far as like orienting my actions around goals. Okay, is what I'm doing, you know, is what I'm doing when I first wake up, is that oriented towards something I actually want to accomplish, or am I wasting time? So I see both sides of it. I see what he's talking about here. And to be fair to James Clear, he mentions both sides of this philosophy throughout the book. But here specifically, he's advocating for very much focusing on your end state and what you want to achieve. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you where, in my mind, these two techniques or tools are very useful, and it's hard for me to properly distinguish when to use one over the other. The easiest is...
You're saying tool in reference to focusing on journey or focusing on destination.
Correct, yeah, yeah. Correct. And I think both of them are useful and we can apply them. I absolutely agree with you on keeping the eye on the target. So when you wake up, what is the thing that you really want to accomplish? In school, if you're trying to achieve a technical degree, bachelor's, PhD, whatever it is, when you're taking classes that you don't necessarily enjoy, but it builds to the foundation of what you want to do, or you're working on a project, heaven forbid, a group project, and you feel the struggle to just get through the end of the project, it's good to reorient, well, I'm doing this thing that I don't want to do in order to achieve a larger success, which is getting that degree. And that orientation and thinking about the destination is very useful to streamline your tasks, activities, habits, and goals all towards walking up to that peak of that mountain that you chose. Now, the other side of that, though, I definitely see enjoying the journey, and instead of focusing on the goal or the destination, it is more useful in certain times to try to lavish yourself in the joy of those tasks or activities. For example, martial arts. If your goal is, well, I just want to get a black belt, then you're going to miss out on all of the, you know, intricate training and the journey and process and the, in my mind, the true meaning of getting a black belt, which typically is called Shodan, which Shodan just means beginning. And so in many classical martial artist mentality is in when you get to your black belt, that's just when you start your training. So instead of focusing on the black belt, oftentimes when I had students, I would say, don't worry about the ranks, don't worry about the belts. Yes, sure, it'll help kind of guide you, but really you should just be enjoying every training, every practice, every bodily movement, because this is more of a long-term lifetime study of you and your body. And I do agree that, say, on a metaphorical hike, you're going to hike for 4 hours, but you're only going to be at the peak enjoying the view for 20 minutes.
Right, yeah. You're hiking for 4 hours, you get up to the spot you want to get to, and then, yeah, it's about, you know, 20 minutes, maybe a little bit longer if you have a meal. And it's like, all right, well, time to keep moving. And I think another lens to look at this through is the time scale. So for short-term and mid-term goals or projects or habits, I think it really helps to stay focused on the target, the end state. And that will help you get to where you want to go. But for a longer-term goal or something much larger, the focusing on the journey, especially like the example of martial arts, that's a lifetime endeavor to perfect getting good at whatever you're working on. That just seems to make it much easier. Same thing in the gym, like with barbell training. You know, there's short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And if I get them confused, or if I over-focus on destiny or journey, you know, there's downsides to both. If I over-focus on the finite goals, then I get really frustrated and I stop enjoying the process. And if I don't focus on the goals enough, because I do and like intrinsically enjoy being in the gym, enjoy doing barbell lifts, if I don't focus on the goals enough, then it's like I run the risk of getting sloppy in my programming or falling off the wagon in certain ways that don't keep me moving along towards those smaller goals. So I think that's definitely an aspect that plays a part, is like the time scale.
Time scale, the finiteness of the event. And honestly, for some people in some situations, you're just not going to enjoy the journey. And that's okay. One of my friends, she had a particular wedding dress that she wanted to fit into. And her wedding, you know, was X number of months away. And she's like, well, and I saw her like, oh, when we're eating or we're hanging out, she would choose, well, I'm going to eat this low calorie thing, because she had her eyes on fitting into that wedding dress. And so she didn't think about like, whoa, this is a lifelong journey of me eating healthy and having a good relationship with food. It was just, I want to fit into this thing. I hate the diet that I'm on. I don't like the working out I'm doing, but I want this end goal. And so she was so dogged on focusing on the goal that it did help form her structure in order to achieve the outcome that she wanted. But she did not enjoy it.
She was very much focused on the goal. Yeah, I mean, there's just some things you can't make enjoyable, you know.
And that's okay.
I don't know. I don't know how you would make stopping smoking enjoyable or stopping drinking enjoyable. I don't know how you would make those enjoyable, you know.
Sometimes it's nice to have.
That's where you just focus on the long-term goal of having a healthier relationship with your body or your habits.
And sometimes it's nice to have not enjoyable things.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. The, you know, another book we read in book club, Comfort Crisis. You know, we as a society have an addiction with comfort. And so it's really difficult for us to think in a productive, practical way about discomfort. You know, we want to flee discomfort when really that's where all the magic happens.
When I think of my travels or stories, I relish the feeling of the discomfort stories that I have that I can share with people. One of my favorites is when we went kayaking and we kayaked for 18 hours for like 36 miles. That was for sure uncomfortable. those are the things that kind of live in my memories, is the enjoyable discomfort that I got to go through, that I chose to go through, that I was blessed to go through.
Yeah, to sit there and deal with some low-grade suffering over a long period of time, that makes a difference if it's voluntary.
Yeah. Like, do you remember when you went caving?
Yeah, I remember that.
I firsthand got to see you be uncomfortable.
I'm happy for you.
And with that, we will conclude today, and we'll finish the rest of the book next week. So thank you so much for joining us on our dialogue on James Clear's Atomic Habits. This has been wonderful. And if you need to reach out to us, please email us at
deepdivebookclub@gmail.com. Give us your comments, your thoughts, your questions, corrections, complaints. We want to hear them. Send them our way.
Sure.
What's our Instagram?
Our Instagram is just Deep Dive Book Club. So you can look us up and you can send us messages on there too. And we'll be happy to reply or add your input into our episodes. Thanks so much for listening. And I think with that, we'll see y'all next week.
See you next week.